nice, knowing they're out there.
Ortega bring any of them in?
It's not her department. The Transmission Felony Division catches a few every now and then, when we squawk loudly enough about it. But dissemination technology being the way it is, it's like trying to throw a net over smoke. And even when you do catch them, the worst they'll get is a few months in storage. It's a waste of time. We mostly just sit on this stuff until Bancroft says we can delete it.
And nothing new in the last 6 months?
Prescott shrugged.
The religious lunatics, maybe. Some increased traffic from the Catholics on Resolution 653. Mr. Bancroft has an undeclared influence in the UN court, which is more or less common knowledge. Oh, and some Martian archaeological sect has been screaming about that song spire he keeps in his hall. Apparently last month was the anniversary of their founder's martyrdom by leaky pressure suit, but none of these people have the wherewithal to crack the perimeter defenses at Suntouch House.
I tilted my chair back and stared up at the ceiling. A flight of gray birds angled overhead in a southward-pointing chevron. Their voices were faintly audible, honking to each other. Prescott's office was environment-formatted, all six internal surfaces projecting virtual images. Currently, her gray metal desk was incongruously positioned halfway down a sloping meadow on which the sun was beginning to decline, complete with a small herd of cattle in the distance and occasional birdsong. The image resolution was some of the best I'd seen.
Prescott, what can you tell me about Lila Bagan?
The silence that ensued pulled my eyes back down to ground level. Alma Prescott was staring off into a corner of the field.
I suppose Kristen Ortega gave you that name, she said slowly.
Yeah, I sat up.
She said it would give me some insight into Bancroft. In fact, she told me to run it by you to see if you rattled.
Prescott swiveled to face me.
I don't see how this can have any bearing on the case at hand.
Try me.
Very well.
There was a snap in her voice as she said it, and a defiant look on her face.
Lila Bagan was a prostitute. Maybe still is. 50 years ago, Bancroft was one of her clients. Through a number of indiscretions, this became known to Miriam Bancroft. The two women met at some function down in San Diego, apparently agreed to go to the bathroom together, and Miriam Bancroft beat the shit out of Lila Bagan.
I studied Prescott's face across the table, puzzled.
And that's it?
No, that's not it, Kovac, she said tiredly. Bagan was 6 months pregnant at the time. She lost the child as a result of the beating. You physically can't fit a spinal stack into a fetus, so that made it real death. Potential 3 to 5 decade sentence.
Was it Bancroft's baby?
Prescott shrugged.
Debatable. Bagan refused to let them do a gene match on the fetus. Said it was irrelevant who the father was. She probably figured the uncertainty was more valuable from a press point of view than a definite no.
Or she was too distraught?
Come on, Kovac.
Prescott jerked a hand irritably at me.
This is an Oakland whore we're talking about.
Did Miriam Bancroft go into storage?
No, and that's where Ortega gets to stick her knife in. Bancroft bought off everybody. The witnesses, the press, even Bagan took a payoff in the end, settled out of court. Enough to get her a Lloyd's cloning policy and take her out of the game. Last I heard, she was wearing out her second sleeve somewhere down in Brazil. But this is half a century ago, Kovac.
Were you around?
No.
Prescott leaned across the desk.
And neither was Kristen Ortega. Which makes it kind of sickening to hear her whining on about it. Oh, I had an earful of it, too, when they pulled out of the investigation last month. She never even met Bagan.
I think it might be a matter of principle, I said gently. Is Bancroft still going to prostitutes on a regular basis?
That is none of my concern.
I stuck my finger through the holographic display and watched the colored files distort around the intrusion.
You might have to make it your concern, Counselor. Sexual jealousy is a pretty sturdy motive for murder, after all.
May I remind you that Miriam Bancroft tested negative on a polygraph when asked that question?
Prescott said sharply. I'm not talking about Mrs. Bancroft. I stopped playing with the display and stared across the desk at the lawyer before me. I'm talking about the other million available orifices out there, and the even larger number of partners or blood relatives who might not relish seeing some meth fucking them. That's going to have to include some experts on covert penetration, no pun intended, and maybe the odd psychopath or two. In short, someone capable of getting into Bancroft's house and torching him. Off in the distance, one of the cows lowed mournfully. What about it, Prescott? I waved my hand through the holograph. Anything in here that begins, for what you did to my girl, daughter, sister, mother, delete as applicable? I didn't need her to answer me. I could see it in her face. With the sun painting slanting stripes across the desk, and birdsong in the trees across the meadow, Amal Prescott bent to the database keyboard and called up a new purple oblong of holographic light on the display. I watched as it bloomed and opened like some cubist rendition of an orchid. Behind me, another cow voiced its resigned disgruntlement. I slipped the headset back on. Chapter 8. The town was called Ember. I found it on the map about 200 kilometers north of Bay City on the coast road. There was an asymmetrical yellow symbol in the sea next to it.
Free trade enforcer, Prescott said, peering over my shoulder. Aircraft carrier. It was the last really big warship anyone ever built. Some idiot ran it aground way back at the start of the colony years, and the town grew up around the site to cater to the tourists.
Tourists? She looked at me.
It's a big ship.
I rented an ancient ground car from a seedy-looking dealership 2 blocks down from Prescott's office and drove north over the rust-colored suspension bridge. I needed time to think. The coastal highway was poorly maintained, but almost deserted, so I stuck to the yellow line in the center of the road and barreled along at a steady 150. The radio yielded a medley of stations whose cultural assumptions were largely above my head. But I finally found a neo-Maoist propaganda DJ, memory-wired into some dissemination satellite that nobody had ever bothered to decommission. The mix of high political sentiment and saccharine karaoke numbers was irresistible. The smell of the passing sea blew in through the open window, and the road unwound ahead of me, and for a while I forgot about the Corps and In-N-In and everything that had happened since. By the time I hit the long curve down into Ember, the sun was going down behind the canted angles of the Free Trade Enforcer's launch deck, and the last of its rays were leaving almost imperceptible pink stains on the surf on either side of the wreck's shadow. Prescott was right. It was a big ship. I slowed my speed in deference to the rise of buildings around me, wondering idly how anyone could have been stupid enough to steer a vessel that large so close to shore. Maybe Bancroft knew. He'd probably been around then. Ember's main street ran along the seafront, the entire length of the town, and was separated from the beach by a line of majestic palm trees and a neo-Victorian railing in wrought iron. There were holographic casters fixed to the trunks of the palms, all projecting the same image of a woman's face wreathed with the words Slipside and Kana Salamao in the Rio Total Body Theater. Small knots of people were out, rubbernecking at the images. I rolled the ground car along the street in low gear, scanning the facades, and finally found what I was looking for about two-thirds of the way along the front. I coasted past and parked the car quietly about 50 meters up, sat still for a few minutes to see if anything happened, and then, when it didn't, I got out of the car and walked back along the street. Elliot's Data Linkage Brokerage was a narrow facade sandwiched between an industrial chemicals outlet and a vacant lot where gulls screeched and fought over scraps among the shells of discarded hardware. The door of Elliot's was propped open with a defunct flat-screen monitor and led directly into the operations room. I stepped inside and cast a glance up and down. There were 4 consoles set in back-to-back pairs, harbored behind a long, molded plastic reception counter. Beyond them, doors led to a glass-walled office. A far wall held a bank of 7 monitors, with incomprehensible lines of data scrolling down. A ragged gap in the line of screens marked the previous position of the doorstop. There were scars in the paintwork behind where the brackets had resisted extraction. The screen next to the gap had rolling flickers, as if whatever had killed the first one was contagious.
"Help you?"
A thin-faced man of indeterminate age poked his head around the corner of one of the sloping banks of console equipment. There was an unlit cigarette in his mouth and a trailing thread of cable jacked into an interface behind his right ear. His skin was unhealthily pale.
"Yeah, I'm looking for Victor Elliott." "Out front."
He gestured back the way I had come.
"See the old guy on the rail, watching the wreck? That's him."
I looked out into the evening beyond the door and picked out the solitary figure at the rail.
"He owns this place, right?" "Yeah, for his sins."
The data rat cracked a grin and gestured around.
"Not much call for him to be in the office, business the way it is."
I thanked him and went back out onto the street. The light was starting to fade now, and Ankana Salamao's holographic face was gaining a new dominance in the gathering gloom. Crossing beneath one of the banners, I came up next to the man on the rail and leaned my own arms on the black iron. He looked around as I joined him and gave me a nod of acknowledgement, then went back to staring at the horizon, as if he was looking for a crack in the weld between sea and sky.
"That's a pretty grim piece of parking," I said, gesturing out at the wreck.
It earned me a speculative look before he answered me.
"They say it was terrorists."
His voice was empty, disinterested, as if he'd once put too much effort into using it and something had broken.
"Or sonar failure in a storm. Maybe both."
"Maybe they did it for the insurance," I said. Elliot looked at me again, more sharply.
"You're not from here?"
he asked, a fraction more interest edging his tone this time.
"No, passing through."
"From Rio?"
He gestured up at Ankana Salamao as he said it.
"You an artist?"
"No."
"Oh."
He seemed to consider this for a moment. It was as if conversation was a skill he'd forgotten.
"You move like an artist."
"Near miss. It's military neurochem." He got it then, but the shock didn't seem to go beyond a brief flicker in his eyes. He looked me up and down slowly, then turned back to the sea.
"You come looking for me? You from Bancroft?"
"You might say that." He moistened his lips.
"Come to kill me?"
I took the hard copy out of my pocket and handed it across to him.
"Come to ask you some questions. Did you transmit this?"
He read it, lips moving wordlessly. Inside my head, I could hear the words he was tasting again.
"For taking my daughter from me. We'll burn the flesh from your head. We'll never know the hour or the day. Nowhere safe in this life."
It wasn't highly original, but it was heartfelt and articulate in a way that was more worrying than any of the vitriol Prescott had shown me on the Rabbit and Rambling Stack. It also specified exactly the death Bancroft had suffered. The particle blaster would have charred the outside of Bancroft's skull to a crisp before exploding the superheated contents across the room.
"Yes, that's mine,"
Elliot said quietly. "You're aware that someone assassinated Lorenz Bancroft last month?" He handed me back the paper.
"That so?" "The way I heard it, the bastard torched his own head off."
"Well, that's a possibility," I conceded, screwing up the paper and tossing it into a refuse-filled trash bin below us on the beach. "But it's not one I'm being paid to take seriously. Unfortunately for you, the cause of death comes uncomfortably close to your prose style there."
"I didn't do it,"
Elliot said flatly. "I figured you'd say that. I might even believe you, except that whoever did kill Bancroft got through some very heavy-duty security systems, and you used to be a sergeant in the Tactical Marines. Now, I knew some tacks back on Harlan's world, and a few of them were wired for covert wet work." Elliot looked at me curiously.
"You a grasshopper?"
"A what?"
"Grasshopper. Off-worlder."
"Yeah." If Elliot had ever been afraid of me, it was wearing off fast.
I considered playing the envoy card, but it didn't seem worth it. The man was still talking.
Bancroft don't need to bring in muscle from off-world. What's your angle on this?
Private contractor, I said. Find the killer. Elliot snorted.
And you thought it was me?
I hadn't thought that, but I let it go, because the misconception was giving him a feeling of superiority that kept the conversation rolling. Something approaching a spark appeared in his eyes.
You think I could have got into Bancroft's house? I know I couldn't, because I ran the specs. If there was any way in, I would have taken it a year ago, because you would have found little pieces of him scattered on the lawn.
Because of your daughter?
Yes, because of my daughter.
The anger was fueling his animation.
My daughter and all the others like her. She was only a kid.
He broke off and stared out to sea again. After a moment, he gestured at the free trade enforcer, where I could now see small lights glimmering around what must be a stage set up on the sloping launch deck.
That was what she wanted. All she wanted. Total body theater. Be like Ancona Salomeo and Rion Lee. She went to Bay City because she heard there was a connection there. Someone who could...
He jarred to a halt and looked at me. The data rat had called him old, and now for the first time I saw why. In spite of his solid sergeant's bulk and barely swelling waistline, the face was old, carved in the harsh lines of long-term pain. He was on the edge of tears.
She could have made it, too. She was beautiful.
He was fumbling for something in his pocket. I produced my cigarettes and offered him one. He took it automatically, lit it from the proffered ignition patch on the pack, but went on fumbling in his pockets until he dug out a small Coda crystal. I really didn't want to see this, but he activated it before I could say anything, and a tiny cubed image sprang up in the air between us. He was right. Elizabeth Elliot was a beautiful girl, blonde and athletic, and only a few years younger than Miriam Bancroft. Whether she had the driving determination and horse-like stamina that you needed in total-body theater, the picture didn't show, but she probably could have given it a shot. The hollow shot showed her sandwiched between Elliot and another woman, who was an almost perfect older edition of Elizabeth. The three of them had been taken in bright sunlight, somewhere with grass, and the picture was marred by a bar of shadow falling from a tree beyond the cast of the recorder across the older woman's face. She was frowning as if she had noticed the flaw in the composition, but it was a small frown, a fractional chiseling of lines between her brows. A palpable shimmer of happiness overwhelmed the detail.
"Gone,"
Elliot said, as if he had guessed who my attention was focused on.
4 years ago. You know what dipping is?
I shook my head. Local color, Virginia Fedora said in my ear. Soak it up. Elliot looked up. For a moment, I thought, at the hollow of Ancona Salomão. But then I saw that his head was tilted at the sky beyond.
Up there,
he said, and jarred to a halt the way he had when he mentioned his daughter's youth. I waited.
Up there, you got the commsats. Raining data. You can see it on some virtual maps. It looks like someone's knitting the world a scarf.
He looked down at me again, eyes shiny.
Irene said that. Knitting the world a scarf. Some of that scarf is people. Digitized rich folks on their way between bodies. Skeins of memory and feeling and thought, packaged up by numbers.
Now I thought I knew what was coming, but I kept quiet.
If you're good, like she was, and you've got the equipment, you can sample those signals. They call them mind bites. Moments in the head of a fashion house princess, the ideas of a particle theorist, memories from a king's childhood. There's a market for this stuff. Oh, the society magazines run edited skull walks of these sorts of people, but it's all authorized, sanitized. Cut for public consumption. No unguarded moments, nothing that could embarrass anybody or damage popularity. Just great big plastic smiles on everything. That ain't what people really want.
I had my doubts about that. The Skullwalk magazines were big on Harlan's world as well, and the only time the consumers protested was when one of the notables they portrayed was caught in some moment of human weakness. Infidelity and abusive language were usually the biggest generators of public outcry. It made sense. Anyone pitiful enough to want to spend so much time outside their own head wasn't going to want to see the same basic human realities reflected in the gilded skulls of those they admired.
"With mind bites, you get everything,"
Elliot said with a peculiar enthusiasm I suspected was a graft from his wife's opinions.
"The doubt, the muck, the humanity, people will pay a fortune for it."
"But it's illegal?" Elliot gestured back at the shop front that bore his name.
"The data market was down. Too many brokers. Saturated. We had a clone and resleeving policy to pay on both of us, plus Elizabeth. My TAC pension wasn't going to be enough. What could we do?"
"How long did she get?" I asked him softly. Elliot stared out to sea.
30 years.
After a while, stare still fixed on the horizon, he said,
"I was okay for 6 months. Then I turn on the screen and see some corporate negotiator wearing Irene's body."
He half turned toward me and coughed out something that might have been a laugh.
"Corporation bought it direct from the Bay City storage facility. Paid 5 times what I could have afforded. They say the bitch only wears it alternate months."
"Elizabeth know that?" He nodded once, like an axe coming down.
"She got it out of me one night. I was jack-happy. Been cruising the stacks all day looking for business. No handle on where I was or what was going on. You want to know what she said?"
"No," I muttered. He didn't hear me. His knuckles had whitened on the iron railing.
"She said, 'Don't worry, Daddy. When I'm rich, we'll buy Mummy back.'"
This was getting out of hand. "Look, Elliot, I'm sorry about your daughter, but from what I hear, she wasn't working the kind of places Bancroft goes. Jerry's bio cabins isn't exactly the houses, is it?" The ex-tech spun on me without warning, and there was blind murder in his eyes and his crooked hands. I couldn't blame him. All he could see in front of him was Bancroft's man. But you can't jump an envoy. The conditioning won't let it happen. I saw the attack coming almost before he knew he was going to do it himself. And I had the neurocam of my borrowed sleeve online fragments of a second later. He hit low, driving under the guard he thought I'd put up, looking for the body blows that would break my ribs. The guard wasn't there, and neither was I. Instead, I stepped inside the hooks of his punches, took him off balance with my weight, and tangled one leg amidst his. He stumbled back against the railing, and I drove a cruel elbow uppercut into his solar plexus. His face went gray with a shock. Leaning over, I pinned him to the rail and jammed the fork of my thumb and fingers into his throat.
"That's enough!"
I snapped, a little unsteadily. The sleeve's neurochem wiring was a rougher piece of work than the core systems I'd used in the past. In an overdrive, the overwhelming impression was of being slung around in a subcutaneous bag of chicken wire. I looked down at Elliot. His eyes were a handbreadth from mine, and despite the grip I had on his throat, they were still burning with rage. Breath whistled in his teeth as he clawed after the strength to break my grip and damage me. I yanked him off the rail and propped him away from me with a cautionary arm.
"Listen, I'm passing no judgments here. I just want to know. What makes you think she has any connection to Bancroft?"
"Because she told me, motherfucker."
The sentence hissed out of him.
"She told me what he'd done."
"And what was that?" He blinked rapidly, the undischarged rage condensing into tears.
"Dirty things," he said. "She said he needed them. Badly enough to come back. Badly enough to pay."
Meal ticket. "Don't worry, Daddy. When I'm rich, we'll buy Mummy back." Easy enough mistake to make when you're young. But nothing comes that easy.
You'd think that's why she died? He turned his head and looked at me as if I was a particularly poisonous species of spider on his kitchen floor.
She didn't die, mister. Someone killed her. Someone took a razor and cut her up.
Trial transcript says it was a client, not Bancroft.
How would they know?
He said dully.
They name a body. Who knows who's inside it? Who's paying for it all?
They find him yet?
Biocabin whore's killer? What do you think? It ain't exactly like she worked for the houses, right?
That's not what I meant, Elliot. You say she turned Bancroft and Jerry's. I'll believe you. But you've got to admit it doesn't sound like Bancroft's style. I've met the man. And slumming? I shook my head. He doesn't read that way to me. Elliot turned away.
Flesh, he said. What are you gonna read in a meth's flesh?
It was nearly full dark. Out across the water on the sloping deck of the warship, the performance had started. We both stared at the lights for a while, heard the bright snatches of music, like transmissions from a world that we were forever locked out of. Elizabeth's still on stack, I said quietly.
Yeah, so what? Re-sleeving policy lapsed 4 years ago, when we sank all the money we had into some lawyer said he could crack Irene's case.
He gestured back at the dimly lit frontage of his offices.
I look like the kind of guy's gonna come into some money real soon.
There was nothing to say after that. I left him watching the lights and walked back to the car. He was still there when I drove back past him on the way out of the little town. He didn't look around. Part 2. Reaction. Intrusion Conflict. Chapter 9. I called Prescott from the car. Her face looked mildly irritated as it scribbled into focus on the dusty little screen set into the dashboard.
Kovacs, did you find what you were looking for?
Still don't really know what I'm looking for, I said cheerfully. You think Bancroft ever does the biocabins? She pulled a face.
Oh, please.
All right, here's another one. Did Lila Began ever work biocabin joints?
I really have no idea, Kovacs.
Well, look it up, then. I'll hold. My voice came out stony. Prescott's well-bred distaste wasn't sitting too well beside Victor Elliot's anguish for his daughter. I drummed my fingers on the wheel while the lawyer went off screen, and found myself muttering a Millsport fisherman's rap to the rhythm. Outside, the coast slid by in the night. But the scents and sounds of the sea were suddenly all wrong. Too muted. Not a trace of bellowweed on the wind.
Here we are.
Prescott settled herself back within range of the phone scanner, looking slightly uncomfortable.
Began's Oakland records show 2 stints in biocabins before she got tenure in one of the San Diego houses. She must have had an entree, unless it was a talent scout who spotted her out.
Bancroft would have been quite an entree to anywhere. I resisted the temptation to say it. You got an image there?
Of Began?
Prescott shrugged.
Only in 2D. You want me to send it?
Please. The ancient car phone fizzled a bit as it adjusted to the change of incoming signal, and then Lila Began's features emerged from the static. I leaned closer, scanning them for the truth. It took a moment or two to find, but it was there. Right. Now can you get me the address of that place Elizabeth Elliot worked? Jerry's closed quarters? It's on a street called Mariposa.
Mariposa and San Bruno.
Prescott's disembodied voice came back from behind Lila Began's full-service pout.
Jesus, it's right under the old expressway. That's got to be a safety violation.
Can you send me a map, route marked through from the bridge?
You're going there? Tonight?
Prescott, these places don't do a lot of business during the day, I said patiently. Of course I'm going there tonight. There was a slight hesitation on the other end of the line.
It's not a recommended area, Kovacs. You need to be careful.
This time I couldn't be bothered to stifle the snort of amusement. It was like listening to someone tell a surgeon to be careful and not get his hands bloody. She must have heard me.
"I'm sending the map,"
she said stiffly. Lila Bagan's face blinked out, and a tracery of grid-patterned streets inked themselves into the place she'd been. I didn't need her anymore. Her hair had been iridescent crimson. Her throat choked with a steel collar, and her eyes made up with startle lines. But it was the lines of the face below it all that stayed with me. The same lines faintly emergent in Victor Elliott's coda-crystal of his daughter. The understated but undeniable similarity. Miriam Bancroft. There was rain in the air when I got back to the city. A fine drizzle sifting down from the darkened sky. Parked across the street from Jerry's, I watched the blinking neon club sign through the streaks and beads of water in the windshield of the ground car. Somewhere in the gloom below the concrete bones of the expressway, a hollow of a woman danced in a cocktail glass. But there was a fault in the caster, and the image kept fizzling out. I'd been worried about the ground car drawing attention, but it seemed that I'd come to the right part of town with it. Most of the vehicles around Jerry's were flightless. The only exceptions to the rule were the autocabs that occasionally spiraled down to disgorge or collect passengers, and then sprang back up into the aerial traffic flow with inhuman accuracy and speed. With their arrays of red, blue, and white navigation lights, they seemed like jeweled visitors from another world, barely touching the cracked and litter-strewn paving while their charges alighted or climbed aboard. I watched for an hour. The club did brisk business. Varied clientele, but mostly male. They were checked at the door by a security robot that resembled nothing so much as a concertinaed octopus strung from the lintel of the main entrance. Some had to divest themselves of concealed items, presumably weapons, and one or two were turned away. There were no protests. You can't argue with a robot. Outside, people parked, climbed in and out of cars, and did deals with merchandise too small to make out at this distance. Once, two men started a knife fight in the shadows between two of the expressway support pillars, but it didn't come to much. One combatant limped off, clutching a slashed arm, and the other returned to the club's interior as if he'd done no more than go out to relieve himself. I climbed out of the car, made sure it was alarmed, and wandered across the street. A couple of the dealers were seated cross-legged on the hood of a car, shielded from the rain by a static repulsion unit set up between their feet, and they glanced up as I approached.
"Sell you a disc, man? Hot spinners out of Ulaanbaatar, house quality."
I gave them one smooth sweep, shook my head unhurriedly.
"Stiff?"
Another shake. I reached the robot, paused as its multiple arms snaked down to frisk me, then tried to walk over the threshold as the cheap synth voice said, "Clear." One of the arms prodded me gently back at chest height. "Do you want cabins or bar?" I hesitated, pretending to weigh it up. "What's the deal in the bar?"
"Ho, ho, ho."
Someone had programmed a laugh into the robot. It sounded like a fat man drowning in syrup. It cut off abruptly.
"The bar is look, but don't touch. No money down, no hands on. House rule. That applies to other customers, too."
"Cabins," I said, anxious to get away from the mechanical barker's software. The street dealers on the car had been positively warm by comparison.
"Down the stairs to the left. Take a towel from the pile."
I went down the short metal-railed flight and turned left along a corridor lit from the ceiling by rotating red lights like the ones in the autocabs outside. Incessant junk rhythm music thrashed the air as if this was the ventricle of some massive heart on tetrameth. As promised, there was a pile of fresh white towels in an alcove, and beyond it the doors to the cabins. I walked past the first four, two of which were occupied, and stepped into the fifth. The floor was satin-sheen padding, about 2 meters by three. If it was stained, it didn't show, because the only illumination came from a single rotating cherry, like the ones in the corridor. The air was warm and stale. Under the sweeping shadows cast by the light, a battered-looking credit console stood in one corner, stock-painted matte black, red LED digital display at the top. There was a slot for cards and cash. No pad for DNA credit. The far wall was frosted glass. I'd seen this one coming, and drawn a sheaf of currency through an autobank on the way down through the city. I selected one of the large denomination plasticized notes and fed it into the slot. Punched the commence button. My credit flashed up in LED red. The door hinged smoothly shut behind me, muffling the music, and a body thudded against the frosted glass ahead with an abruptness that made me twitch. The display digits flickered to life. Minimal expenditure so far. I studied the body pressed against the glass. Heavy breasts pressed flat, a woman's profile, and the indistinct lines of hips and thighs. Piped moaning came softly through hidden speakers. A voice gusted.
"Do you want to see me, see me, see me?"
Cheap echo box in the vocoder. I pressed the button again. The glass unfrosted and the woman on the other side became visible. She shifted, side to side, showing herself to me. Worked-out body, augmented breasts, leaned forward and licked the glass with the tip of her tongue, breath misting it again. Her eyes locked onto mine.
"Do you want to touch me, touch me, touch me?"
Whether the cabins used subsonics or not, I was getting a definite reaction from it all. My penis thickened and stirred. I locked down the throbbing, forced the blood back out and into my muscles the way a combat call would do. I needed to be limp for this scene. I reached for the debit button again. The glass screen slid aside and she stepped through like someone coming out of a shower. She moved up to me. One hand slid out, cupping.
"Tell me what you want, honey,"
she said, from somewhere in the base of her throat. The voice seemed hard-edged, deprived of the vocoder effect. I cleared my throat. "What's your name?"
"Anemone. Want to know why they call me that?"
Her hand worked. Behind her, the meter was clicking over softly. "You remember a girl used to work here?" I asked. She was working on my belt now.
"Honey, any girl used to work here ain't gonna do for you what I am. Now how would you..."
She was called Elizabeth. Her real name, Elizabeth Elliot. Her hands fell abruptly away, and the mask of arousal slid off her face as if it was greased underneath.
"What the fuck is this? You the seer?"
"The what?"
"The seer, the heat."
Her voice was rising. She stepped away from me.
"We had this, man."
"No." I took a step toward her, and she dropped into a competent-looking defensive crouch. I backed up again, voice low. "No. I'm her mother." Taut silence. She glared at me.
"Bullshit! Lizzie's ma's in the store."
"No." I pulled her hand back to my groin. "Feel. There's nothing there. They sleeved me in this, but I'm a woman. I couldn't..." She unbent fractionally from her crouch, hands tugging almost unwillingly down.
"That looks like prime tank flesh to me,"
she said untrustingly.
"You just come out of the store. How come you're not paroled in some bone bag junkie sleeve?"
"It's not parole." The Corps' deep cover training came rocketing in across my mind like a flight of low-level strike jets, spinning vapor trail lies on the edge of plausibility and half-known detail. Something inside me tilted with the joy of mission time.
"You know what I went down for?"
"Lizzie said mind bites. Something..."
"Yeah. Dipping. You know who I dipped?"
"No. Lizzie never talked much about..."
"Elizabeth didn't know. And it never came out on the wires."
The heavy-breasted girl put her hands on her hips.
"So who..."
I skinned her a smile.
"Better you don't know. Someone powerful. Someone with enough pull to unstack me and give me this."
"Not powerful enough to get you back in something with a pussy, though."
Anemone's voice was still doubtful, but the conviction was coming up fast, like a bottleback school under reef water. She wanted to believe this fairy tale mother come looking for her lost daughter.
"How come you're cross-sleeved?"
There's a deal, I told her, gliding near the truth to flesh out the story. This person gets me out, and I have to do something for them. Something that needs a man's body. If I do it, I get a new sleeve for me and Elizabeth.
That's so. So why are you here?
There was an edge of bitterness in her voice that told me her parents would never come to this place looking for her, and that she believed me. I laid the last pieces of the lie.
There's a problem with re-sleeving Elizabeth. Someone's blocking the procedure. I want to know who it is and why. You know who cut her up?
She shook her head, face turned down.
A lot of the girls get hurt,
she said quietly.
But Jerry's got insurance to cover that. He's real good about it. Even puts us into store if it's going to take a long time to heal. But whoever did Lizzie wasn't a regular.
Did Elizabeth have regulars? Anyone important? Anyone strange?
She looked up at me, pity showing in the corners of her eyes. I'd played Irene Elliott to the hilt.
Mrs. Elliott, all the people who come here are strange. They wouldn't be here if they weren't.
I made myself wince.
Anyone important?
I don't know. Look, Mrs. Elliott, I liked Lizzie. She was real kind to me a couple of times when I got down, but we never got close. She was close with Chloe, and...
She paused, and added hurriedly.
Nothing like that, you know, but her and Chloe and Mac, they used to share things, you know, talk and everything.
Can I talk to them?
Her eyes flickered to the corners of the cabin, as if she had just heard an inexplicable noise. She looked hunted.
It's better if you don't. Jerry, you know, he doesn't like us talking to the public. If he catches us...
I put every ounce of envoy persuasiveness into stance and tone.
Well, maybe you could ask for me.
The hunted look deepened, but her voice firmed up.
Sure, I'll ask around, but not now. You gotta go. Come back tomorrow, the same time, same cabin. I'll stay free for this time. Say you made an appointment.
I took her hand in both of mine.
Thank you, an enemy.
My name's not an enemy,
she said abruptly.
I'm called Louise. Call me Louise.
Thank you, Louise. I held on to her hand. Thank you for doing this.
Look, I'm not promising anything,
she said with an attempt at roughness.
Like I said, I'll ask. That's all. Now you go, please.
She showed me how to cancel the remainder of my payment on the credit console, and the door hinged immediately open. No change. I didn't say anything else. I didn't try to touch her again. I walked out through the open door and left her standing there with her arms wrapped around her chest and her head down, staring at the satin-padded floor of the cabin as if she was seeing it for the first time, lit in red. Outside, the street was unchanged. The two dealers were still there, deep in negotiations with a huge Mongol who was leaning on the hood of the car, looking at something between his hands. The octopus arched its arms to let me pass, and I stepped into the drizzle. The Mongol looked up as I passed, and a flinch of recognition passed over his face. I stopped, turning in mid-step, and he dropped his gaze again, muttering something to the dealers. The Nurikem came online like a shiver of cold water inside. I moved across the space to the car, and the sparse conversation between the three men dried up instantly. Hands slid into pouches and pockets. Something was pushing me. Something that had very little to do with the look the Mongol had given me. Something dark that had spread its wings on the low-key misery of the cabin. Something uncontrolled that Virginia Vidara would have bawled me out for. I could hear Jimmy DeSoto whispering in my ear. "You waiting for me?" I asked the Mongol's back, and saw how the muscles in it tensed. Maybe one of the dealers felt it coming. He held up his exposed hands in a placatory gesture.
"Look, man,"
he began weakly. I sliced him a glance out of the corner of my eye, and he shut up.
"I said..."
That was when it all came apart. The Mongol pushed himself off the car hood with a roar and swatted at me with the arm the size of a ham.
The blow never landed, but even deflecting it, I staggered back a pace. The dealers skinned their weapons, deadly little slabs of black and gray metal that spat and yapped in the rain. I twisted away from the traceries of fire, using the Mongol for cover, and shot a palm heel into his contorted face. Bone crunched, and I came around him onto the car while the dealers were still trying to work out where I was. The Norikim made their movements into the pouring of thick honey. One gun-filled fist came tracking toward me, and I smashed the fingers around the metal with a side-flung kick. The owner howled, and the edge of my hand cracked into the other dealer's temple. Both men reeled off the car, one still moaning, the other insensible or dead. I came up into a crouch. The Mongol took off, running. I vaulted the roof of the ground car and went after him without thinking. The concrete jarred my feet as I landed, sent splinters of pain lancing up both shins, but the Nurikem damped it down instantly, and I was only a dozen meters behind. I threw out my chest and sprinted. Ahead of me, the Mongol bounced around in my field of vision like a combat jet trying to elude pursuing fire. For a man of his size, he was remarkably fast, flitting between the marching support pillars of the expressway and into the shadows a good 20 meters ahead now. I put on speed, wincing at the sharp pains in my chest. Rain slapped at my face. Fucking cigarettes. We came out from under the pillars and across a deserted intersection where the traffic lights leaned at drunken angles. One of them stirred feebly, lights changing as the Mongol passed it. A senile robot voice husked out at me. "Cross now, cross now, cross now." I already had. The echoes followed me beseechingly up the street. Past the derelict hulks of vehicles that hadn't moved from their curbside resting places in years. Barred and shuttered frontages that might or might not be rolled up for business during daylight hours. Steam rising from a grate in the side of the street like something alive. The paving under my feet was slick with the rain and a gray muck distilled from items of decaying garbage. The shoes that had come with Bancroft's summer suit were thin-soled and devoid of useful grip. Only the perfect balance of the Nurikim kept me upright. The Mongol cast a glance back over his shoulder as he came level with two parked wrecks, saw I was still there, and broke left across the street as soon as he cleared the last vehicle. I tried to adjust my trajectory and cut him off, crossing the street at an angle before I reached the wrecked cars, but my quarry had timed the trap too well. I was already on the first wreck, and I skidded trying to stop in time. I bounced off the hood of the rusting vehicle into a shop front shutter. The metal clanged and sizzled. A low-current anti-loitering charge stung my hands. Across the street, the Mongol stretched the distance between us by another 10 meters. A wayward speck of traffic moved in the sky above me. I spotted the fleeing figure on the other side of the street and kicked off from the curb, cursing the impulse that had made me turn down Bancroft's offer of armaments. At this range, a beam weapon would have carved the Mongol's legs out from under him easily. Instead, I tucked in behind him and tried to find the lung capacity from somewhere to close up the gap again. Maybe I could panic him into tripping. That wasn't what happened, but it was close enough. The buildings to our left gave way to wasteland bordered by a sagging fence. The Mongol looked back again and made his first mistake. He stopped, threw himself on the fence, which promptly collapsed, and scrambled over into the darkness beyond. I grinned and followed. Finally, I had the advantage. Perhaps he was hoping to lose himself in the darkness, or expecting me to twist an ankle over the uneven ground. But the envoy conditioning squeezed my pupils into instant dilation in the low light surroundings and mapped my steps over the uneven surface with lightning speed, and the Nurikem put my feet there with rapidity to match. The ground ghosted by beneath me the way it had beneath Jimmy DeSoto in my dream. Given 100 meters of this, I was going to overtake my Mongol friend, unless he too had augmented vision. In the event, the wasteland ran out before that, but by then there was barely the original 12 meters between us when we both hit the fence on the far side. He scaled the wire, dropped to the ground, and started up the street while I was still climbing, but then abruptly he appeared to stumble. I cleared the top of the fence and swung down lightly. He must have heard me drop, though, because he spun out of the huddle, still not finished clipping together the thing in his hands. The muzzle came up, and I dived for the street. I hit hard, skinning my hands and rolling. Lightning torched the night where I had been. The stink of ozone washed over me, and the crackle of disrupted air curled in my ears. I kept rolling, and the particle blaster lit up again, charring past my shoulder. The damp street hissed with steam in its wake. I scrambled for cover that wasn't there.
"Lay down your weapon!"
A cluster of pulsating lights dropped vertically from above, and the loudspeaker barked down the night like the voice of a robot god. A searchlight exploded in the street and flooded us with white fire. From where I lay, I screwed up my eyes and could just make out the police transport. A regulation crowd control 5 meters off the street, lights flashing. The soft storm of its turbines swept flapping wings of paper and plastic up against the walls of nearby buildings and pinned them there like dying moths.
"Stand where you are,"
the loudspeaker thundered again.
"Lay down your weapon."
The Mongol brought his particle blaster around in a searing arc, and the transport bucked as its pilot tried to avoid the beam. Sparks showered off one turbine where the weapon found its mark, and the transport sideslipped badly. Machine rifle fire answered from a mounting somewhere below the vessel's nose, but by that time the Mongol was across the street, had torched down a door, and was gone through the smoking gap. Screams from somewhere within. I picked myself slowly up off the ground and watched as the transport settled to within a meter of the ground. An extinguisher canister fumed into life on the smoldering engine canopy and dripped white foam onto the street. Just behind the pilot's window, a hatch whined up, and Kristen Ortega stood framed in the opening.
Chapter 10. The transport was a stripped-down version of the one that had given me the ride out to Suntouch House, and it was noisy in the cabin. Ortega had to shout to make herself heard above the engines.
"We'll put in a sniffer squad, but if he's connected, he can get stuff that'll change his body's chemical signature before dawn. After that, we're down to witness sightings. Stone Age stuff. And in this part of town..."
The transport banked, and she gestured down at the warren of streets below.
"Look at it. Licktown, they call it. Used to be called Potrero way back. They say it was a nice area."
"So what happened?"
Ortega shrugged in her steel lattice seat.
"Economic crisis. You know how it is. One day you own a house, your sleeve policy's paid up. The next you're on the street looking at a single lifespan."
"That's tough."
"Yeah, isn't it?"
the detective said dismissively.
"Kovac, what the fuck were you doing at Jerry's?"
"Getting an itch scratched," I growled. "Any laws against it?" She looked at me.
"You weren't getting greased in Jerry's. You're barely in there 10 minutes.
I lifted my own shoulders and made an apologetic face. "You ever been downloaded into a male body straight out of the tank? You'll know what it's like. Hormones. Things get rushed. Places like Jerry's, performance isn't an issue." Ortega's lips curved in something approximating a smile. She leaned forward across the space between us.
"Bullshit, Kovac. Bullshit. I accessed what they've got on you at Millsport. Psychological profile. They call it the Kemmerich gradient. And yours is so steep you'd need pitons and rope to get up it. Everything you do, performance is going to be an issue."
"Well..." I fed myself a cigarette and ignited it as I spoke. "You know, there's a lot you can do for some women in 10 minutes. Ortega rolled her eyes and waved the comment away as if it was a fly buzzing around her face.
"Right. And you're telling me with the credit you have from Bancroft, Jerry's is the best you can afford?"
"It's not about cost," I said, and wondered if that was the truth of what brought people like Bancroft down to Licktown. Ortega leaned her head against the window and looked out at the rain. She didn't look at me.
"You're chasing leads, Kovac. You went down to Jerry's to follow up something Bancroft did there. Given time, I can find out what that was, but it'd be easier if you just told me."
"Why? You told me the Bancroft case was closed. What's your interest?" That brought her eyes back around to mine, and there was a light in them.
"My interest is keeping the peace. Maybe you haven't noticed, but every time we meet, it's to the sound of heavy-caliber gunfire."
I spread my hands. "I'm unarmed. All I'm doing is asking questions.
And speaking of questions, how come you were sitting on my shoulder when the fun started?
Just lucky, I guess.
I let that one go. Ortega was tailing me, that much was certain. And that, in turn, meant there had to be more to the Bancroft case than she was admitting. What's going to happen to my car? I asked.
We'll have it picked up. Notify the rental company. Someone can come and get it from the impound. Unless you want it.
I shook my head.
Tell me something, Kovach. Why'd you rent a ground car? On what Bancroft's paying you, you could have had one of these.
She slapped the bulkhead by her side.
I like to go places on the ground, I said. You get a better sense of distance that way, and on Harlan's world, we don't get up in the air much.
Really? Really. Listen, the guy who nearly torched you out of the sky back there...
Excuse me?
She cranked up one eyebrow, in what by now I was beginning to think of as her trademark expression.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we saved your sleeve back there. You were the one looking down the wrong end of the hardware.
I gestured. Whatever. It was waiting for me.
Waiting for you?
Whatever she really thought, Ortega's face was disbelieving.
According to those stiff dealers we loaded into the wagon, he was buying product. An old customer, they say.
I shook my head. He was waiting for me. I went to talk to him. He took off.
Maybe he didn't like your face. One of the dealers, I think it was the one whose skull you cracked, said you were looking jacked up to kill someone.
She shrugged again.
They say you started it, and it certainly looks that way.
In that case, why aren't you charging me?
Oh, with what?
She exhaled an imaginary plume of smoke.
Organic damage, surgery reparable to a pair of stiff peddlers, endangering police property, breach of the peace in Licktown. Give me a break, Kovach. This sort of thing goes down every night outside Jerry's. I'm too tired for the paperwork.
The transport tipped, and through the window I could see the dim form of the Hendrix's tower. I'd accepted Ortega's offer of a ride home in much the same spirit as I had the police lift out to Suntouch House, to see where it would take me. Envoy wisdom. Go with the flow and see what it shows you. I'd no reason to suppose Ortega was lying to me about our destination, but still part of me was surprised to see that tower. Envoys aren't big on trust. After an initial wrangle with the Hendrix about landing permission, the pilot set us down on a grimy-looking drop pad atop the tower. I could feel the wind tucking at the transport's lightweight body as we landed, and as the hatch unfolded upward, the cold came battering aboard. I got up to go. Ortega stayed where she was, watching me go with a lopsided look that I still couldn't work out. The charge I'd felt last night was back. I could feel the need to say something pressing on me like an impending sneeze.
Hey, how'd the bus go down on Cadman?
She shifted in the seat and stuck out one long leg to rest her boot on the chair I'd just vacated. A thin smile.
Grinding through the machine, she said. We'll get there.
Good. I climbed out into the wind and rain, raising my voice.
Thanks for the lift.
She nodded gravely, then tipped her head back to say something to the pilot behind her. The whine of the turbines built, and I ducked hurriedly out from under the hatch as it began to close. As I stepped back, the transport unglued itself and lifted away, lights flashing. I caught a final glimpse of Ortega's face through the rain-streaked cabin window. Then the wind seemed to carry the little craft away like an autumn leaf, wheeling away and down toward the streets below. In seconds, it was indistinguishable from the thousands of other flyers speckling the night sky. I turned and walked against the wind to the drop pad's access staircase. My suit was sodden from the rain. What had possessed Bancroft to outfit me for summer with the scrambled weather systems that Bay City had so far exhibited was beyond me. On Harlan's world, when it's winter, it stays that way long enough for you to make decisions about your wardrobe. The upper levels of the Hendrix were in darkness, relieved only by the occasional glow of dying aluminum tiles. But the hotel obligingly lit my way with neon tubes that flickered on in my path and died out again behind me. It was a weird effect, making me feel as if I was carrying a candle or torch.
"You have a visitor,"
the hotel said chattily, as I got into the elevator and the doors whirred closed.